Hello, I'm Kirsty Young. Thank you for downloading this podcast of Desert Island Discs from BBC Radio 4. For rights reasons, the music choices are shorter than in the radio broadcast. For more information about the programme, please visit bbc.co.uk/radio4. My castaway this week is the veteran pilot Tony Iverson, one of only a handful of men to fly in the Battle of Britain and Bomber Command. His life has been packed full of adventure and daring. As a boy, the cartoon exploits of Biggles fired his dream to take to the skies. Indeed, the week of his 21st birthday was marked not so much by cards and cake than by being shot down in his Spitfire over the North Sea. Initially reported missing in action, he went on to fly in the three raids that finally sunk the German battleship, the Tirpitz. He hasn't really put his feet up since, with a successful career in broadcasting, campaigning for a permanent memorial to the thousands of airmen killed in RAF Bomber Command, and even returning to the skies in a Lancaster bomber aged 89. He says, "We were in a total war for our survival. Total war is a brutal, nasty, uncivilised business. We just got on with the job." So, Tony Iverson, this year, I understand, you travelled to California and you met quite an interesting fellow, a man called, is it Kurt Schultz in California?
Yes.
Tell me about Kurt Schultz. Why did you meet him?
Well, I met him at Berkeley University a few years ago when a symposium was put on about the sinking of Tirpitz. And he, it appeared, was a pilot in a German fighter squadron, which was moved 40 miles south of Tromsø, where Tirpitz was sitting. And for some extraordinary reason, he and his colleagues missed us in their Messerschmitts. And when I met Kurt, and he tried to explain all this to me, and as I got to know him better, I got to like him very much.
And how did it feel to shake the hand of a man who was in within just a few seconds of probably killing you?
Well, it's very strange, actually, when you realise that you're both airmen, both had a job to do, and, well, we sort of hugged each other and were glad that we hadn't met in the skies over Norway.
Was there a sense in which you felt you maybe had much more in common with Kurt than you have with many people who haven't been through a war, even though you were on opposing sides?
I think airmen all over the world have a great deal in common. And once you find out, if you meet a stranger, that he too was a pilot, there's no problem. You've got lots and lots of things to talk about.
And what's the tie you're wearing today? What's that tie?
This is the 617 Squadron tie, the Dam Busters.
Yes.
It shows the lightning striking the dam.
Is it always very close to the surface with you, all of those experiences? I mean, you know, the drama of your life, for those of us who've not been through a war, is almost unimaginable. I'm wondering if you feel that it sort of almost informs every day that you live, that experience that you went through.
Well, because for 10 years I've been chairman of the Bomber Command Association.
Yeah.
And we have several gatherings a year. And mainly in the last 3 years, it's been the memorial which has occupied my days and nights and weekends and thoughts. So that, yes, it's all come back to me.
Plenty to talk about, Tony Iverson, but for now we're going to listen to some music. Tell me about the first disc that we're going to hear. Why have you chosen this, and tell me what it is?
Well, my first record takes me back to 1943, when I was on my way into Bomber Command, and the one thing senior officers did not want was someone arriving to go on a mission and suddenly saying, I can't go, I've got violent toothache. So we all had to go to the dentist and pronounced dentally fit.
Right.
The dentist I met had just returned from New York, and whilst he was probing, he played Frank Sinatra, and I didn't know who it was, but I was very taken by the voice. So I guess I might have been amongst the first few people ever to hear Sinatra in this country.
You do something to me, something that simply mystifies me. Tell me, why should it be? You have the power to hypnotize me. Let me live neath your spell. Do
that voodoo. That was Frank Sinatra and You Do Something to Me. I dare say one of the very few things that could make a dental appointment seem a little more bearable, Tony Iverson. You're 91 now. You could so easily pass for about 25 years younger than that. You seem very robust and healthy looking.
Wow, you're very complimentary.
Well, I'm not being overly flattering, but you do look in remarkable shape. You were 25 then when the war finished. I'm wondering what you think the legacy has been for you personally of going through that at such a young age.
Well, I think most flying people would agree with me that being a pilot or a member of our crew makes one very self-reliant. Well, you appreciate that what happens is in your own hands. And if you go through a few experiences, you then find out a great deal about yourself, about how much you can take, and those experiences, even the bad ones, are helpful for the future. But what it taught me was that I could rely on myself, that I had some skills and I had some capacity.
Somebody once wrote of you, they said, he flies like those wings are riveted to his shoulders. Only a couple of years ago, I think when you must have been 88, 89, you had the opportunity to fly a Lancaster bomber again. What was that experience like getting back into the cockpit?
It was far more emotional than I expected. The Lancaster is a war machine. It's very cramped and far more so than I remembered. And when they gave me the controls, they were much heavier than I remembered. And it started wandering off, as if the Lancaster was saying to me, if you think you can come back after 60-odd years and carry on, well, have another think.
And the emotions were thinking back to what? Did you think of a particular episode?
Well, I got out of that aeroplane and looked at it and thought about operations. I really did wonder, how did we do it? I know it was a long time ago, and I was young and fit, and I was a professional flyer, really, at the time. But I thought about some of my friends who had been lost, and it was an emotional experience.
Many tens of thousands killed in RAF Bomber Command. I think it's over 55,000 airmen. I wonder what you make of the fact that today, of course, we are week in, week out, losing servicemen and women in action in Afghanistan and Iraq. Every individual is named. We see their photographs on the evening news and in the papers. Do you think we're right to commemorate every individual loss in that way these days?
Well, it's inevitable, I think, because the losses are spaced out and one is moved by seeing the coffins arriving. One night in March 1944... Bomber Command lost 95 aircraft, which is nearly 700 airmen, in one night. They couldn't, obviously, because they were shot down on the other side, so they could not be brought back. But if there was a cortege of 700, what would we do? It's so different today.
Let's have some more music then, Tony. What are we going to hear now? We're on disc number two.
Well, disc number two, Tommy Dorsey playing I'm Getting Sentimental Over You, is a wonderful, wonderful melody, and he was a great trombonist. When I was about 17, with two friends, we set up a nightclub called the Ebony Shadows on the upper floors of his parents' house. The great advantage was that halfway up the final staircase there was a window which looked out on the next-door pub, where there was also a window, so unknown to his parents, we could wangle in a few bottles of beer. And occasionally we would persuade a girl to come to our Ebony Shadows.
The sound of Tommy Dorsey and his orchestra, and I'm Getting Sentimental Over You. Let's go way back then. Tell me a bit about your father. He had fought in the Battle of the Somme on July 1st, 1916. Did he ever talk to you about that?
A little bit, not much, but it was quite obvious he had a terrible scar on his chest where the bullet had come out. he'd volunteered in August 1914. He joined the Royal Fusiliers, and he went over the top on that day, first day of the Somme, and was hit within a few moments. They were all very heavily laden with a pack on their back and a rifle, and he was knocked over by this bullet which hit him. He'd only gone about 10 yards, and so he fell. He fell down, and he fell on his back, and therefore, and he couldn't move, and he couldn't get out a water bottle, and he laid there the whole day, and it was a hot day. And it was lucky that late, towards the evening, that they found him.
One of the most extraordinary aspects, I think, of your father's life is that he fought again. He fought at Passchendaele. He must have been a man of extraordinary nerve and courage to be able to go out there and fight again.
Well, I think he would have said it was in the line of duty. He came home and from the first wound and recovered and sent out again, as many, many thousands and thousands were.
Let's go back to 1919. That was the year you were born. I mentioned in the introduction that as a little boy you would read the comic stories about Biggles and, you know, all the heroes and what they would get up to in wartime. Did you feel that your life in those early years was sort of dominated by the prospect of war or the shadow of war?
Well, certainly by the time I was about 11 years old, I would hear my father and uncle and others saying, "Are we really going to have to fight Germans again?" And they were horrified at the prospect.
Your father and mother especially, given that they were the parents to four sons, I mean, they must have, you know, almost have been able to see that looming fate of what was coming for their young boys.
Yes, I think my parents' generation was the one that suffered worst. They were married in April 1917, and she'd known him before, so she'd had a man in France. And then within 20 years, there's another war, and she had four sons. What they endured is quite incredible.
Time now to have some more music then, Tony. Tell me what we're going to hear now. We're on disc number 3.
I was very interested in flying. All I wanted to do was to fly. And at that time, our heroes were pioneer aviators. So people like Amy Johnson, who, as a typist, learned to fly, and took off and flew solo to Australia. And Alan Cobham was trying to make Britain air-minded and used to take his flying circus around the country. In fact, I had my first flight in an Alan Cobham show, and I believe that many, many Battle of Britain pilots did likewise.
How old would you have been when you were taken up at the air show?
I'd be about 14, I think. We did a circuit and landing, and the pilot, when the landing run stopped, turned around and said, "Well, that's it." And I said, "Is that all?" He said, "Well, I'll give you another one." So I got two the price of one.
There's a little lady who has captured every heart, Amy Johnson, it's you. We have watched and waited since the day you made your start, Amy Johnson, it's true. Since the news that you are safe has come along, everyone in town is singing this love song. Amy, wonderful Amy.
That was Jack Hilton and his orchestra, and Amy, wonderful Amy. I have to tell people, Tony Iverson, that you were singing along to that pretty well. You got quite a good voice. Was she something of a pin-up girl then, Amy, for you?
Oh, yes, she was, because she went on. She married a man called Jim Mollison, who was another pioneer aviator, and they set up lots of records crossing the Atlantic in a single-engine monoplane.
So you were the eldest then, Tony, of four boys, as we know. Your father had fought and then went on to be a policeman.
Yes.
Yes. What sort of dad was he then? Was he pretty strict with his four boys?
Yes, he was strict, but he wasn't over strict.
No.
We knew when dad something, it meant something.
Right. And what did he, you know, in terms of your sort of behaviour, was it, you know, shoes polished and shirt and tie on a Sunday and all that sort of stuff?
Yes, to some degree. We were always well turned out. He was always very smart himself. And he was very, very keen on our getting a good education and doing well once we were given the opportunity. What he wanted, I think, for us after the experience of the 20s and the Great Depression was that we should find a job which had security. Well, I wanted to join the RAF on a short service commission when I was 17, but he wouldn't countersign my applications. He said, 4 years flying, what are you going to do after that? These 4 years are very important to your education. And then when the time came when conscription was introduced and I would have had to go anyway into the army, that's when he relented and allowed me to apply for the RAF Volunteer Reserve.
You yourself went on to have four children. Of course, there was, you know, a marked difference given when you were a dad in terms of teenagers' expectations and so on. Did you try to parent in the way that your parents had parented you, or did you just accept that times had changed?
I think because of my service experience, I was tending to be a disciplinarian. But I think through influences you learn, and perhaps more relaxed than my parents had been.
Yes, you think you were then, because your children would have been growing up in the 60s, yeah?
Yes.
Yes, not really the time to be a disciplinarian father.
No. No, you'd get real defiance. I tried to not get involved in a situation where there was no backing down. Right.
That was probably your military training too, you know when to quit when you're ahead.
Perhaps, yes.
Let's have some more music then. What are we going to hear next? We're on disc number four, Tony.
Well, next you're going to hear Danny Kaye, that extraordinary, wonderful entertainer of the 50s and 60s. And this piece, Tubby the Tuba, was a great favourite with my children. Poor Tubby couldn't quite get involved with the orchestra, and suddenly a miracle happened and he became the star of the show, and they absolutely loved it.
Why, how perfectly wonderful, said the strings. Please, Tubby, may we sing your tune too? How about me, said the xylophone. And me, said the trombone. May I, said the celeste.
Here I come, said Peepo.
And they all play.
That was Danny Kaye and Tubby the Tuba, or indeed Tubby the Tuba, as I think he said. Now, you joined the RAF Reserves, as you say, before war broke out. And so by 1940, you were among the famous few who fought in the Battle of Britain. Your family were sent a telegram saying that you were missing in action. Tell me about that. What happened?
Well, they certainly had their eye on the ball, because that telegram probably arrived the morning after the action.
Yes.
It was my first sortie. We were on a convoy patrol, three of us, and suddenly the air seemed to be full of flak. And when we looked around, there was an aircraft above us, and my flight commander said, well, tally-ho, and off we went. So when I finally saw this aeroplane with this Junkers with one engine on fire, and as I got as close as I could, the rear gunner woke up and plastered my aeroplane. I felt things thudding into it. One piece took a corner of the windscreen off. So I dived away, and so did he. I never saw him again. And I had a sick aeroplane on my hands. The engine wasn't functioning properly. Temperatures were slowly rising. Pressure was slowly dropping. I was still losing altitude steadily. Right on the far horizon, there were a few dots, and I steered towards them. But by that time, I was down to a height where I knew I'd have to go into the sea. And I'd been told you should try and land along the waves and not into them.
Because the impact,
yes,
of going into them will kill you.
And I just steadily put it in.
Did you at any point think, this is it, I'm done for?
Do you know, I'm not sure. I think I was a bit busy. And I had a Mae West, which was an inflatable life jacket. And I saw them trying to launch a lifeboat from the nearest ship. And for sometime as they were paddling towards me. I was on top of a wave and so were they. And then we... And in the end, I was shouting, I won't be here.
They did pick you up, of course, then. And what sort of first aid did they administer? How were you taken care of on board the minesweeper?
Well, they dragged this shivering, sodden sergeant pilot and took me on board and filled me with rum and took me into the engine room, which was very, very hot, and took off my uniform, which eventually dried almost stiff, too stiff to put on.
And so, as we know, your parents had received the telegram giving them almost the worst news, which is missing in action. Was it your mother who opened the front door when you came home?
Do you know, I can't remember how I arrived at home, or I think my father took it in his stride. They'd been through a lot, you know, and they weren't demonstrative as perhaps we might be today.
I'm wondering about your parents, Tony. We were talking about, you know, the grim times that they lived through and the degrees of austerity that they had to deal with. Later on in life, did life get easier for your parents once their children were up and grown?
Yes, yes, it did.
Right. In terms of what? Money was presumably...
Well, yes,
tight.
Money, and they moved house to out in the country. Yes, it got much better for them.
Let's have some more music, Tony. Tell me what we're going to hear now. We're on disc number 5.
The next record I'd like is the Dam Busters March, and as a member of that squadron, although I joined them a year after the dams, I met some of the great survivors. On the way into Bomber Command on my course, we talked about 617, but we thought of it either as suicide squadron or the squadron to which you really could only go with experience. And when my CO said, well, Wing Commander Leonard Cheshire, who was then commanding the squadron, will be happy to see you tomorrow. This great legend of a pilot, although he was only 2 years older than me, I could hardly believe it. And I was the first pilot to go to that squadron without previously flying bombers.
Was the band of the RAF regiment and the Dam Busters March. So, Tony Iverson, you told us that you were invited to join 617 Squadron, famous by then for successfully using these bouncing bombs to destroy the German dams. And you've said that for you it was understandably a great honour to be asked to join them. But you also said they were known as the Suicide Squadron. Now, I'm wondering when you flew with them. By this time, were you already married at this
yes.
point? Right. How difficult was that then to leave your wife, Christine, at home and to know that you were in such danger?
Well, in today's terms, it may seem a bit difficult, but lots and lots of other people were doing it then. It wasn't so unusual. People were sent away in those days for 3 and 4 years. Soldiers fighting in the desert and in Italy and people at sea. It was a very, very different period indeed.
Tell us then a bit about this mission which finally sank the Tirpitz. Can you describe what she looked like when you first saw this ship? I mean, she was a grand vessel, wasn't she?
Tirpitz was a huge vessel approaching the fjord. I saw over the nose of the Lancaster, but only as a sort of black shape. My bomber said it looked like a dinky toy from 15,000 feet, the huge vessel though it was.
And when you got back from that mission, what happened? What sort of reception did you get?
Well, we got telegrams from everybody. Churchill, the King, Eisenhower, the Navy even.
It's impossible, Tony, to talk about all your missions in detail because there were many, many other missions, including one which saw you awarded the Distinguished Flying Cross. But I'm wondering if, after the Battle of Britain, Churchill gave the speech where he said it was necessary to take the war to Germany. His words were to pulverise their entire industry and scientific structure on which their war effort and economic life depends. Now, that was a big speech at the time, and he was rallying the nation and rallying people like you who were putting their life on the line. After the war, the government and he sought to sort of distance themselves from those actions. What were your feelings about that?
We were very, very, very disappointed. Churchill asked for Master of the Air. We'd given it to him by 1945. When we had a reunion after the war, the only one we ever had at the Albert Hall at that time, I think we were all very, very, very furious about the view about Bomber Command, because in his victory speech, Churchill mentioned almost everybody, but not Bomber Command, as a contributor to the victory.
You spent much of the past 10 years as chairman of the Bomber Command Association. You will know that there is a small but very vocal minority who think that there shouldn't be a permanent commemorative memorial because it's a part of Britain's history that they feel conflicted about, and some of them even feel ashamed of it. What would you say to those people?
All I can say is most of them, or all of them, are post-war. They had no idea what situation we were in 1940. If the Luftwaffe had defeated Fighter Command, and if the Germans had been able to land here, well, we would have been occupied and subjugated. It was total war. We were fighting for our existence, and the only way we could touch Germany was through Bomber Command.
And the critics, of course, you'll have heard them say this, say that, you know, it's the bombing of the civilians was the thing that they objected to. How would you reply to that?
Well, we weren't bombing civilians. We were bombing German industry. Bear in mind, the Germans killed 43,000 of our civilians between September 40 and May 41, and would have gone on doing so had we not taken the war in the air over the rooftops of German cities.
Planning permission for a permanent memorial has now been given for RAF Bomber Command. The more complex bit of the story is that there's a lot of funds still to be raised. Are you confident you will see it built in your lifetime?
Yes, I'm very confident. Lots and lots of people have worked hard, and we've had lots of support and contributions. And what we need really now, on top of it, is to provide the funds for its care and maintenance in the future.
All right, let's take a break for some music then. Tell me what your next record is, Tony. We're down at
The next record I'd like to hear is the Brook Violin Concerto. And the reason for that is it was my second wife's very, very favourite piece of music. So although she died in France, I organised a memorial service in the Actors' Church in Covent Garden so that her friends and colleagues could say goodbye to her. And we had a solo violinist who played this piece.
The Adagio from Brook's Violin Concerto, played by Kyung Hwa Chung with the Royal Philharmonic Orchestra, conducted by Rudolf Kemper. And that piece of music was chosen for Margie, your second wife. You were married for 35 years. And is it true? Do you know, Tony, who Simon Cowell is?
Well, I've heard of him.
Yes. We'll leave it at that. But Simon Cowell now is a very well-known talent show judge. You yourself were something of a a Simon Cowell in television, were you not? You were a talent show judge. How did that happen?
Well, it happened because I was an honorary member of an RAF mess in Yorkshire, and so was a wonderful man called Barney Colahan, who produced on radio the Wilfred Pickles shows.
Yes.
And he went into television, and he was putting together a programme called Top Town on television, where towns would be asked to produce an entertainment package and compete against each other, and he wanted a panel of judges. And I was a sort of, not quite the man in the street, but people like Ted Kavanagh, who wrote the script for Itmar, and a wonderful principal boy of the 30s called Dorothy Ward.
And how did you find it? I mean, somebody with your background, how did you find the sort of glossy, shallow world of television after what you'd done?
Well, I enjoyed it.
Did you? And when you were on live television, I mean, of course, it all was live then. There was nothing really that was pre-recorded. Did you get a bit of an adrenaline rush? Did you sort of enjoy the live element of it?
I enjoyed it very much. It was in the very early days of Granada in the north of England. I just loved it.
Doesn't the rest of life, after what you had been through in the war and all your experiences as a fighter pilot, doesn't the rest of life seem a little bit sort of washed out and colourless by comparison?
No, it doesn't seem that, but it did teach me that the problems one met in civilian life could be solved, and they weren't quite as major as taking off on a filthy night from the north of Scotland knowing you were going to be in the air for 12 and a half hours.
Let's have some more music then. What are we going to hear now?
After the war, I found serious music, shall we say. When I had my first job, it was based in London, and I went to many promenade concerts. And Tchaikovsky became one of my favourite composers. I just loved his music.
That was the 11th variation of Tchaikovsky's Suite No. 3 in G, played by the London Philharmonic Orchestra, conducted by Sir Adrian Bolt. As you said, Tony Iverson, your second wife, Margie, died in 1997. She died of a brain tumour. I wonder if at that point and that stage in your life that you thought that you would play out the rest of your life alone. Did you think that?
Yes, I don't know whether I looked deliberately at the future and thought about it, but that would seem to have been the possible pattern.
But that's not been the case.
No.
Tell me what happened.
Well, many years ago, I was a flying instructor in Rhodesia, and there in the same flight was a certain individual. And we became very, very good friends indeed. And just after the war, he came down to Bournemouth, where I was based, and brought along his stepdaughter, who was 14. So that's when I first met her. Well, I kept in touch with him, and I got to know her mother, and Mary, I met her husband, and I used to get the odd card from her. So when Marjorie died, I'd been invited to, by many people in England, from when I'd living in France, to go around, and I thought, I'd better do it instead of putting them off. So I telephoned Mary and said, well, I'd very much like to meet again, which we did in Bath. And I was, I think I've got to say, when I saw her there, I just fell in love with her. And fortunately, she seemed to think that she'd like to spend some time with me. And so two or three years after Marjorie's death, her husband had been dead then for many years, sadly. We just enjoyed each other's company so much, and I've been incredibly lucky in finding her and the fact that she wants to share things with me.
And you have 7 grandchildren. Is it 3 great-grandchildren you
yes.
have? I imagine that the remaining RAF friends that you have and you keep in touch with, they must feel like a sort of extended family too, do they? I mean, you know so much about their lives and you've been through so much with them.
Yes, the Royal Air Force is a great family, and the people I met and served with and still know are very great people indeed.
Right. Let's have your final piece of music today, then. What are we going to hear?
This is a very favourite melody. It's the most beautiful melody, and if I remember rightly, it was kind of discovered not too long ago. And it seemed to come along just about the time I met with Mary. So I associate this tune very much with her.
That was part of Albinoni's Adagio in G minor, played by the Berlin Philharmonic, conducted by Herbert von Karajan. So, Tony Iveson, we come to the point in the programme where I'm going to give you the Bible and the complete works of Shakespeare, and you get to take one of your own books. What do you want to take along?
Well, I would like the 3 volumes of Somerset Maugham's short stories. He is a magnificent storyteller, and I would never tire of them.
Right. Well, we shall hope that we can find those 3 somehow fused into one book. And a luxury, too. You can have something to make life just a little nicer. What luxury would you like?
I would like to try and develop my own little vineyard.
Ah.
And therefore, I'd like 2 established vines, 1 Sauvignon Blanc and the other a Grenache wine, plus, please, a biggish tin bath. Perhaps within a year I might harvest a few grapes to tread in the bath and give me a conch shell of wine.
Right. I shall give you then those vines and indeed even a tin bath to go with them to tread your grapes. If you had to choose just one track of these 8 discs we've heard today, if you were to save one, which one would you save?
I would choose the last one.
That's the Albinoni.
The Albinoni, yes.
Right. It's yours. Tony Iveson, thank you very much for letting us hear your Desert Island Discs.
Well, thank you for inviting me.
You've been listening to a download from the BBC. You'll find more information on the Radio 4 website, bbc.co.uk/radio4.